Morning, everyone. This is Radio Shalom 104.6 FM. Today it's a special day because we're gonna interview Professor Dov Bing. Hello, Professor
Hello.
Dov Bing.
Good morning.
And this is about the Holocaust. He's got a personal story to share with us about life and Shoah and Holocaust. But before that, I want to read to you something that I just wrote on my way to the studio. And this is what it's about. I mean, I believe that every nation has her own Shoah, her own personal pain. Every person has his or her own personal Shoah, personal pain. Some still live in a huge pain of memories. Some wants to forget, but they can't. Our nation of Israel suffered from many different kinds of Shoah. The last one is the Holocaust. Millions of Jewish people were murdered for their religion. Children, babies, men, women, old ones, all of them were butchered by the Nazis or by terrorists. And what did the world do to stop it? Nothing. Today, the biggest Shoah to humanity is when people have lost their compassion for one another, when the majority of the good people stand by and do nothing. Do we live in a world where it's politically correct to be anti-Semitic? Do we live in a world where it's politically correct to ignore the murder of thousands of children who get murdered every day by cold blood by Assad regime in Syria? Do we live in a country where it's politically correct to support Hamas in Gaza? Where is the real story? What happened to our society? Why do we ignore it? All across the world, Jewish and Israelis are remembering the Holocaust. This is the day when we have Yom HaShoah, a day where we pay respect to the memories of millions of Jews that were murdered by the Nazis. We can't forget. And our history, unfortunately, repeats itself over and over. Today, we have a special story of Professor Dov Bing. Just a few words. Can you please represent yourself to the audience?
Yes, I was born in Holland in 1939, just before the war. I'm from a family with six children. My father was arrested by the Nazis in 1944 when he was in hiding on a farm in Heurigewaard, a small village next to Alkmaar. He was given away by collaborators. The Nazis surrounded the farm and put a gun on the old farmer, Mr. Kout. And they basically said to him, "We know that Eli Bing is hiding here on this farm. If you don't tell us, we shoot you." And the old farmer realized that they meant it. So he just said, "Well, he's in the hay barn. He's hiding there." So they got my father out. And the first thing they did is they took him to the place where we were, where the family was, with my grandmother. And they told him to get a suitcase with a toothbrush and a few other pieces of clothing, giving the semblance that they, you know, would treat him kind of well. Then they forced him basically to say farewell to us. And what I remember extremely well from that day is that I stood in front of my father. And he said, "You're a very naughty boy. Will you be good to your mother?" That was the last I saw of my father. They took him on the train with Landwachten, these were SS collaborators, to Amsterdam, and in front of the central station, he jumped off the tram. He was very athletic. He was 40 years old. He was running to these little streets opposite the old quarter, close to the central station. But unfortunately, on the opposite side, six German soldiers came marching. So he was, he couldn't go back where they tried to catch him, the SS people, and in front were the Germans too. So he walked into the canal and swam 25 meters underwater to the opposite side, hoping to escape. And when he came up for air, the SS Dutch collaborator shot him through the head. There was a small note in the newspaper the next day that they had found somebody in the canal. They pretended they didn't know who it was. And my mother was called the next day to Amsterdam, to the Binnengasthuis hospital, to recognize the body. A week later, the underground in Heergewaard contacted my mother and said, "We have information that tomorrow morning the SS is coming to arrest you and your children, and you have to go immediately into hiding." There were only 4 hours left of the day, and my mother had to act immediately. My three older brothers were sent each to a different farmer in the village, and I went on the train with my mother and my sister, younger, 2.5 years younger sister Ellen. My younger sister Naomi, she wasn't born yet. My mother was pregnant with number 6. We went on a train, first to Amsterdam, from Amsterdam to Arnhem, in the eastern part of the country, and then to a place called Oosterbeek. I do not remember anything about the trip to Amsterdam, but I have recollections about the trip from Amsterdam to Arnhem. We were sitting, in front of us were German officers, and in the back of us, there were very rowdy German soldiers. We were sitting in the middle, and before we got onto the train, my mother had called me and said, "You like to talk to everybody, whoever it is, and this time you have to keep your mouth closed. You can't talk to anybody. Our lives depend on it." I was 5 years old. I understood the seriousness of the situation. And even though it was difficult, I didn't talk the whole trip. I have no recollection whatsoever about how long we stayed in Oosterbeek, who the people in Oosterbeek were. I've tried to find out, to thank the family for looking after us, and with the help of an archivist in Alkmaar, we have done our very best, but we haven't been able to find that family. So I remember growing up in considerable poverty. After the war, we went to Alkmaar. We moved from the village. And I remember diving under the table when the grocer knocked at the door, asking my mother to pay her bills. My mother was just an amazing woman. She brought all of us up. All of us got an education. She came to visit me twice in New Zealand. During the period 1940-1945, my grandmother, Sientje Bing Englander, was arrested. on the 3rd of March 1942 in Alkmaar. The people who arrested her was the Dutch police. They collaborated. They brought her to the railway station together with my aunt Sarah and my uncle Johnny and my uncle Ari, the brother and sister of my father. They were taken. It was snowing. A story I heard afterwards from somebody who contacted me was that one Dutch family brought my grandmother to the railway station in a cart with a horse and had made a hot water bottle for her. When they arrived at the railway station, my grandmother was exhausted and she wanted to sit down inside the waiting room. The Dutch police came up to her and said, "You're not supposed to sit here. Just go outside and stand in the snow," and then the snow coming down. In Amsterdam, they were put in the Jewish quarter in Amsterdam. And in 1942, they were all sent to Sobibor, where they were murdered. Of my whole Bing Englander family, 122 members perished during the Holocaust. I myself visited with a high school friend Westerbork, the first camp where they were sent to before they went to Sobibor. I haven't been able to manage to go to Sobibor, but I think with my eldest son Ira, I think we have plans this year to go to Sobibor and pay our respects to our family members.
Well, that's quite a sad story.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit that I have a lot of respect for people who's been through all of this Shoah and managed to survive after they lost their beloved ones. And today you are a professor. Like, I mean, the poverty and whatever the Nazis did to you obviously didn't break, I would say, your motivation, your will to survive, to live in spite of the pain and make it and be here with us today. And I guess your mother was a very strong woman, because I don't know how you can do that.
No, we just marvel at her. It is just extraordinary. Not only that, in Alkmaar after the war, there were hardly a Jewish community because most of the people had been murdered. Close to 76% of all the Dutch Jews were murdered during the Holocaust. Before the war, there were 140,000 Jews in Holland. 30,000 of them had come, like the Anne Frank family, from Germany, thinking they would be able to go to Holland because Holland had been neutral during the First World War and that in the Second World War they would be taken care of and that Germany would leave Holland alone. But Hitler had different plans. He wanted to take Great Britain, and for that he needed the Dutch coast. So he invaded in 1940. He invaded Holland and bombed Rotterdam and took over almost immediately. There was a very brave kind of underground during the war, but I'm afraid to say that of the 76% Paris, that is one of the highest figures in Europe, together with Poland and Greece. Many more Jews survived in Belgium. One of the reasons is that it's much more hilly country, more forests. And also the Belgians, they experienced the First World War. They knew the Germans and were therefore much braver to stand up against them. There is a story of a group of Jews who traveled from Belgium through the German lines to Poland to help people in the Warsaw ghetto, in the ghetto uprising. This is kind of extraordinary. in France, although the Vichy regime collaborated, and that story has finally come out. Belgium apologized to the Jewish community in the last 3 years on 3 occasions by the Prime Minister. Most other European countries did. But the only country which hasn't apologized to the Jewish community is Holland. The extraordinary thing is that many people believe that the Dutch were wonderful to the Jews. And one of the reasons for this, this is the story of Anne Frank. People believe yes. that people believe that Anne Frank was helped by so many wonderful Dutch people, allowed them to survive for so long during the war in Amsterdam, that everybody else in Holland was like that, but that's not really the case. And I remember when I arrived in 1963 in Israel, in Tel Aviv, I asked somebody the way to a particular kind of institution, and he immediately recognized my Dutch accent with my new Hebrew. And he said, well, he said, you know, the Dutch were wonderful during the war, together with the Danes. They were outstanding. And at the time, I didn't know too much about the details of what happened in the war, and I believed it. But since I've found out that the real story about what happened in Holland is quite different, and it's about time that the Dutch come to terms with this and apologize for their collaboration. It's not only the police which collaborated.
It's the people themselves as well.
The interesting thing is that the Dutch queen left the country for England. It was against the constitution. It was really, she committed high treason. And she took all her ministers with her, so there was nobody to defend. Seyss Inquart, who was an Austrian Nazi appointed by Hitler to look after Holland, he could immediately appoint all Germans to make all the decisions, and therefore it was much easier to arrest the Dutch Jews and send them to the concentration camps. In Belgium, the king stayed on. In Denmark, the king stayed on, and that meant that according to state law, the Germans had to go through the Danish government and the Belgian government, and so there was a possibility for people to leak to the Jewish community that they were going to be arrested so they could kind of flee. In Holland, that wasn't possible. What is interesting is that many Jewish historians after the war who wrote about what happened in Holland have covered this up. And only about 15 years ago, Nanda van der Zee, a young historian, wrote a very brave book about 200 pages in which he basically told about the responsibility of the Dutch royal house and how they had collaborated during the war. The right wing in Holland was furious. They called her a Nazi. But it's slowly starting to sink in what happened. And I think one of the reasons why the Dutch government, it's the Party for Freedom and Democracy, which has a party which has an excellent pedigree during the war. They were in the underground. Their prime minister is refusing to apologize, and he's refusing to explain why he's not willing to apologize. He's not willing to apologize for the deeds because that means criticism of the Queen Wilhelmina.
Wow. Amazing story. I mean, I know from my own, I mean, not my experience, from my grandmother experience, right. They actually left North Africa. They came from, my grandmother is from yes. Morocco before yes. France. Yes. And from my understanding, the king of Morocco make it extremely difficult for the Nazis to find yes. where the Jews were hiding.
It's a story.
So he didn't give them the list. He made the bureaucracy quite complicated.
Yes.
And in a way, he gave the Jewish people a bit of, you know, more time to flee. And fortunately also, you know, America invaded and you know, yes. they defeat them with Rommel in North Africa. Yes. And that was really lucky because the next day my grandmother was supposed to go on the train.
Right, right.
Well, and this is the story of Morocco Jews who yes. were actually saved, I would say, part of the story that they were saved by the Moroccan king. Yes. And unfortunately,
in a Muslim country, there are two exceptions on what happened. Most of it was collaboration in Europe, and the two exceptions were in North Africa, Morocco, and in Europe, Bulgaria. Bulgaria also, they did an excellent job in standing up to the Nazis and not kind of participating and collaborating with them. Yes.
How do you live with this pain, with these memories of a child who is 5 years old and just saw his father being taken away from him and coping with all of these difficulties? How do you cope with that?
I grew up in Alkmaar. I remember at primary school, I was only once called a dirty Jew, and then I punched the person in the face. And once it happened in the intermediate school. But apart from that, I never heard an anti-Semitic remark. Although it was difficult for our family to grow up there because everybody, it was a town with 30,000 people, everybody knew everybody. My father had a kosher butchery and was very well known in the city. His father had been a butcher too in the town. So it was a very well-known family. And everybody knew what happened to my father and my and the rest of my family. And people just didn't know how to deal with it. They didn't want to bring it up for probably they thought it would upset me and my brothers and sisters. But it's very difficult to grow up in a kind of vacuum. It was just like I was sitting on a cloud. And nobody could reach me. And so it was a kind of liberation for me and other family members. My sister Ellen came and my sister Naomi came to Israel. My brother Gerson is still living in Herzliya.
What year did your family left to Israel?
I was the first one, I went in 63.
63?
Yes.
Well, how come you didn't leave straight after the war?
Because we were very isolated. There was nobody, I cannot remember, a male figure coming to our house to visit us. When I asked my mother what happened to our friends, they said, well, your father's friends were mostly Jewish. They're all dead.
Yeah.
And she said, and who wants to come and visit a widow with six children?
Yes.
So other people who knew was they just stayed away.
And so the Jewish agency wasn't back then.
The Jewish agency was in Amsterdam. They didn't reach out. The first time I went in 63 to the Sochnut in Amsterdam, and I said I want to go and study Hebrew and then go to the Hebrew University. They immediately said, well, where are you from? I said, from Alkmaar. But you're not on the books. Nobody knows about you.
I see. They didn't know about you even.
Okay. My mother was a very proud person. She didn't want to really ask anybody for help. Very independent. But then they went to see her, etc. And they immediately increased her state allowance. And she afterwards lived quite well. But
until then, how did she manage to support all of you?
Well, weekly she had to go to the municipality to get an allowance, which was not really enough to live on. It was very difficult. I remember when I just said, could we have something on bread? And she had one expression, she said, bread is with satisfaction. That means there was nothing on the bread. You had to be satisfied.
Yes.
And then she said, okay, you can go to the butcher around the corner. Now, if Jan is there, he used to work for your father. He's a very nice man. He will write it down for you, and then I'll pay later. When that was, we don't know, really.
Yeah.
But if the woman is there, she's a bitch. And you have to avoid her. Can you imagine to be 10 years old, to go and stand kind of 100 meters from the butchery and try to peep inside who was standing behind the counter and waiting till the woman was gone and Jan was standing there?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
That sounds
so it wasn't,
quite a lot for a 10-year-old boy.
Yes, it wasn't easy.
And do you get a nightmare from the whole thing?
Yes, I have post-traumatic stress syndrome. And especially the last meeting where my father said goodbye to me, that is a very difficult thing to live with. But I have, in New Zealand, while...
What do you do today in New Zealand?
I retired. I'm emeritus professor now at Waikato University in political science department. I was appointed to 71, so I taught for 46, 47 years. I love teaching.
What did you teach?
Political science, international relations. My specialty was China, but in the last 20, 25 years, I gave a first-year course on Israel and the Palestinians, and a graduate course on strategic issues in the Middle East. And most of my publications have been on the political history of the Chinese Communist Party, on which I wrote my doctorate. And I've been invited on numerous occasions to Chinese institutions, both in Taiwan and in Beijing and Shanghai, to lecture on my research. And I'm still writing about that. My interest and kind of dealing with what happened to my family has been to stand up to anti-Semitism, be it in the community or in the university, and to stand up to Holocaust denial. And in the year 2000, there were some famous cases in New Zealand where Joel Hayward, a master's student at Canterbury University, finished a thesis about what he called Holocaust revisionism. These are really Holocaust deniers. And instead of doing a kind of critical analysis of these Holocaust deniers, he basically endorsed what they stood for.
How did he base it? On what?
On being very kind of biased and making things up, basically. He concluded his last chapter, for which he had no evidence, he concluded that there had been no gas chambers at Auschwitz. And he got an A+ for his thesis from both the examiner, Professor Orens, and from the external examiner, Professor John Jensen from Waikato University.
Unbelievable, unbelievable.
Anyhow, he was able to hide his thesis for 6 years by pretending it was going to be published. And the Canterbury University collaborated basically with him. I cannot give any other word for it. In the meantime that he did that, he enrolled for a PhD and completed it. And by the time he was exposed, he was already a senior lecturer at Massey University. When I wrote an article in the Jewish Chronicle indicating what he had done, and the university council of that university immediately set up an inquiry to what happened.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Dovbing.
You're
Unfortunately,
welcome.
Today our program is just about to finish, so I have to say goodbye to our listeners and to you as well. But we are more than happy, actually, to interview again about Holocaust denial.
Yes, I'd be happy to do so.
In New Zealand,
yes.
And talk about your research and what in your findings.
Right.
Obviously, you have an amazing life story, and you are a proof for, you know, what a good will can do, and that even you know, maybe the Germans were able to kill us physically, but they never ever managed to take our spirit away.
No, they didn't.
And you still have the spirit of fighting and standing up for yourself. Yes. And I just adore that. Good. Thank you, Dov.
Thank you.